Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. One of the latest releases from FedSoc Films is Taking Poletown, a community's fight over economic justice and eminent domain. The city of Hamtramck, Michigan became known as Poletown when the first waves of Polish immigrants came to Detroit to settle in the 1870s. But by 1981, the residents of Poletown were legally forced to relocate by General Motors and the cities of Detroit and Hamtramck, which claimed eminent domain in order to make way for a new automobile plant. Taking Poletown showcases the battle waged by the residents of Poletown to stop GM and the city of Detroit while using eminent domain to take Poletown and lose this historic community forever. Today on the FedSoc Films Podcast, we have Tim Hedberg, director and producer of Taking Poletown. Tim is a bilingual filmmaker, entrepreneur, and all-around media maverick who co-founded Motivo Media and heads up their Seattle office. Tim has been a visiting professor at Universidad Francisco Marroquín's Film School in Guatemala City and speaks regularly at conferences and events around the world. Also on today's podcast, we have Matt Wood, director of FedSoc Films, where he leads a talented team of filmmakers to make compelling stories about important legal, historical, and policy-driven issues. Matt was also an executive producer and one of the writers of Taking Poletown, and he also co-hosts the FedSoc Films podcast. Welcome to the FedSoc Films podcast, Tim, and welcome back, Matt.
Thank you so much. It's really exciting to be here.
Indeed. Thank you, Samantha. Thanks for having me back on.
So I'd like to kick things off with a short clip from the film Taking Poletown. Take a listen.
So there was sort of a cantankerous guy on lived on Cantor Street. His name was John Saber. He used to sit on his front porch with a shotgun. He said, anybody tries to take my property, I'll shoot them. But eventually, he had to move out. And as time went on, the houses, the buildings disappeared one by one.
So Matt and Tim, how did Taking Poletown come to fruition?
Well, I'll kick that off because it started on the FedSoc film side of things before it got into the hands of Tim and his team. And it ultimately started a couple years back when news came that the plant that was built where the previously mentioned Poletown used to be, where that neighborhood used to be, it was announced in, I think, either 2018 or 2019 that GM was going to be closing that plant down. And so that brought this issue back into the public sphere. This happened all in the 1980s, around 1980. And the clip that you just heard was one of the characters in the film, Bruce, who's a photographer. And it's him talking about how many of the characters or residents who lived in Poletown, many of them wanted to stay. Many of them agreed to take the money from the eminent domain that was offered for their homes, but many of them also fought that. But a Supreme Court case later from the Michigan Supreme Court, also known as Poletown, allowed the taking to take place, and the homes disappeared one by one, as Bruce said in that clip. And so 30 years later, or I guess closer to 40 years later, when this came back into the public sphere because GM was going to be closing that plant down, it was actually Daniel T. Richards, who at the time was the VP of digital and helped run FedSoc Films. He originally pitched this idea of, well, let's take a look at this case from history, when eminent domain was used. And now that there's this turn and the plant is shutting down, it's a good time to examine the issue, both as it stood 40 years ago, but also now looking back with hindsight, what can we learn from this? So that's where it originally came to be. We wanted to make a short documentary about that. And we reached out to Tim, who has worked on a number of FedSoc films and I've known for quite a long time, for him and his team to basically take the ball and turn this into a film, the film that you can now see on YouTube and in various film festivals.
Great.
Yeah. And when I first heard from you, Matt and Daniel about this project, I was just really excited by the approach that you all wanted to take, which is to really dive into history and retell a story that may be forgotten by many, but do so authentically and truly, and to go back into that city and find the best voices that we can to help us get an understanding from the various perspectives, because it was such a heated and vicious debate at the time and had huge implications and repercussions, both, you know, at that time and to today, like all the way to today. I think the implications of those court cases are still, playing out. And so getting to go back in and find a journalist, a photographer, a former Supreme Court justice, one of the leading lawyers who was in favor of the Polltown decision, you know, who's still living today and writing today. And even to go back and talk to community residents who had their home taken and others who benefited directly from it. It was just a really beautiful experience to get to be a conduit for all of those voices and try to bring them into some kind of harmony or synergy and to put it into a film that can really help us elucidate the key ideas, messages, and outcomes from a variety of viewpoints.
Yeah, and you guys did such a fantastic job of finding those characters that you just mentioned. You could have interviewed many other people for the film, but you managed to find, I would say, close to the perfect cast of experts and characters to represent what happened during the time, but can also who can talk about it now. I mean, and we'll probably get into that in this podcast, but that was, I think, one of the most special things about this film was the people you were able to find and have featured in the film. I think that's really what brought this whole thing to being such a good film.
You know, I couldn't agree more, and I'm just very grateful that the people featured in the film chose to give us their trust and to allow us to interview them and tell their story. And, you know, as you mentioned, it really is a magical group of people who together, their voices really do create, I think, a very balanced, harmonious, yet still distinct and important discussion about the topic. And, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, you know, I really cherish each and every one of not only those people's appearances and their words, but the experience of sitting down to actually interview them, right? Where we're looking eye to eye with the film set around us in a new location every other time that I talk to somebody and getting to ask them these questions that, you know, I myself am curious about. Because as you do research on a film, and I tried to read everything I could and talk to as many people as I could, I had so many curiosities and so many questions. And I was just really, really excited to get their authentic take on this very important discussion. And so I just, you know, wanted to say, I'm just extremely grateful for all of those people.
Tim, were there any surprises or delightful discoveries that you made in the process of making Polltown?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that the entire process was full of discoveries and surprises. The first thing that I did when, you know, Daniel and Matt came to us with this project and provided a creative brief was to go, you know, start reading about it and researching it, but also to reach out to just about everybody that I know from that community in that area of the country who may have a contact or a relationship. Because with documentary films, most of the powerful subjects I've ever found, it's not through Google searches, but it's from connections and relationships, right? Because the people who are there on the ground know of the people who would be best for the story. So, you know, as I started reaching out to various organizations and friends of mine and former colleagues, I started to get in touch with, you know, for example, Justice Young, the former Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, and had a wonderful conversation with him, and he wanted to participate. And then I met Greg Kowalski, who runs the Hamtramck Historical Museum, but also was a journalist for many, many years. And, you know, the key with these early conversations is to describe to your subject what it is you're on a mission to accomplish, do so accurately, and if and find out if they are on that same page with you. And if they are, oftentimes they open more doors. So Greg connected me to Bruce, who is one of the main characters of the film, and he was getting his MFA in photography at the time and has over 600 original photos that he took during the demolition of that community. And once I chatted with Bruce and I could just feel his energy, he would be a good fit. He wanted to participate in this project and would offer a very distinct and awesome viewpoint. And I found that to be a really huge surprise that he wanted to participate and to go back and give us a tour of the community and show us, you know, what changed between the time he took the photos and today. And then, you know, there's so many other characters that, you know, I discovered, but to your point, Samantha, many of those characters I actually didn't find until I actually got on the ground there. So I had maybe three or four characters lined up, but I knew flying into Detroit, I kind of had that little pit in your stomach where you're like, look, these are an amazing group of people, but I know that I needed more and I needed a couple other voices and I just trusted that we would find them. And sure enough, we did. You know, a couple of those are Karen, the current mayor of Hamtramck. You know, I didn't get an email back from her until I was actually on the ground in Detroit. And she agreed to have us come down to her shop that she runs in Hamtramck, a thrift shop, a consignment shop. And we got to interview her and to have an active, you know, mayor of the community that was, you know, impacted by this to participate was really incredible. And then in addition to that, I didn't find our bar owner of Susie's until, you know, we got on the ground and I started walking myself into the various bars around that town just to ask, hey, does anybody here know about what happened in Poletown? And one of the first bars I walked into, the bartender said, yeah, I was a resident of Poletown. You know, my family lived there and we had to have our house taken. And, wow. You know, I chatted with him for a couple minutes and he said, hey, if you come back in an hour, I might be able to talk to you. So, you know, we ran over there with our cameras and lights and sure enough, he was there and we were able to get an interview with him. And I thought that was one of the most important voices, which is the voice of somebody who had to move because of what occurred. And so just, you know, throughout the whole journey, I mean, you know, in addition to that, there were multiple people who sort of dropped out of the film once we arrived for random reasons. You know, we were going to interview a Polish bakery and for whatever reason, when we arrived, that was no longer a possibility. And so it really had to, this whole project, we had to be extremely flexible and take the surprises, both positive and negative as they come and not allow it to affect our mood and our mindset and to continue, you know, persevering through all of the challenges and surprises to get to where we ended up, which is with this really, really incredible and powerful film.
What were some of the obstacles or troubles you had during production on taking Poletown?
Wow. Yeah, there were a handful. I mean, you know, one example of an obstacle was finding a location to interview Bruce. And if you watch the film, you can tell that we're in a really old, but also character, you know, a full of character building. And, you know, we worked with our production assistant to get permission to film there. And we had just started rolling cameras on Bruce's interview. We had set up lights. And about like 1 minute into the interview, a security guard comes up to us and shuts us down and says, you can't film here. You don't have the right permissions. You know, this is actually a really expensive place to film. And we had to make a decision. And so I said, hey, do you mind if I talk to the building owner? You know, I thought that we had the right permissions, but obviously something, you know, some miscommunication occurred. So he took us down to the main office and they quote me for an extremely large amount of money that we did not have available. You know, it was, you know, multiple, you know, four figures. And so, you know, I ended up just sitting down with the owner and explaining that this is a nonprofit project that's meant to educate the public about this topic and who Bruce is, you know, this photographer. And long story short, after explaining what it was that we're doing, you know, and sending them over some additional documents, they ended up giving it to us at a very, very reasonable price that allowed us to continue and finish that interview.
Wow.
And that was a really important moment because had we not been able to finish that, that would have potentially, devastated the schedule because we were on a very, very tight and compact schedule. So being able to just finish that interview, despite being an hour or two delayed at this point, really enabled us to continue on with the purposes that we had there. So that was, you know, one obstacle. Another obstacle that a lot of other filmmakers will probably cringe as I tell this mini story was that we were flying in a director of photography from Los Angeles who we've worked with for quite a while and who I really, you know, I love his cinematography. So he agreed to come on for the project. And, you know, he was going to arrive the night before our first day of production, which the very first thing we were filming upon his arrival was the Chief Justice, Justice Young's interview in the downtown courthouse. So, you know, Ben has a connection in a city, I believe it was Colorado. And I get a text from him saying that his next flight had been canceled and he was in Colorado and it was now 9 p.m. and we needed to get him in that night in order to start the interview at 7 a.m. the next morning. So we try to start rebooking flights and finding another opportunity for him to fly in. And through, you know, 2 to 3 hours of phone calls with every airline, we found one more flight that would get him in at 2 a.m. that night. So we hop on that flight. He gets in only to find out that his bags were not delivered. And when I say his bags, I mean our cinema camera did not arrive. Our lights did not arrive. Our microphones that we were using to record audio did not arrive. It was just Ben without any of the gear. So wow. Here we are now. He arrives at 4 a.m. because we had to go pick him up without the gear. And in 3 hours, we're filming at the downtown Supreme Court building. Ben didn't even have a change of clothes with him because everything was in those bags. So, thankfully, Ben Wade, who was on the production with us, was able to identify a local production company. And we called them and got in touch with them. And they lent us some of the necessary gear. And then I had one of my cameras with me that, you know, wasn't of the same quality, but good enough. And then, you know, Ben Wade had a small DSLR with him. So we were able to put together the bare essentials necessary to film that interview. And that interview was done without a boom. It was just, you know, two lav mics. And upon arriving to set and setting up, you know, all of us now extremely tired, you know, none of us had really slept that night. We didn't have the gear we expected. And, you know, the audio wouldn't stop crackling the entire interview. You know, both lav mics were in his jacket and rubbing back and forth, and we didn't have the right audio gear. And we just had to continue, you know, push through and realize, hey, we're going to do the very best we can. And we are talented enough and competent enough to fix this, you know, in post, which is the worst thing you ever want to hear on a production, which is we'll fix it in post. But I think this is that exception where you recognize there is nothing more we can do right now. And so sure enough, the interview was fantastic. You know, we got the great content and the audio, sure enough, was incredibly crackly the entire time. But long story short, we brought in an audio engineer at the very end of the project to do some really fantastic work on that audio and clean it up and get it to a very, very nice place. So that's just another Indeed. Example of a challenge we faced. And I could go on. There were many, many more little mini problems and crises along the way. But at the end of the day, I think I learned a very valuable lesson of doing the very best you can, not letting the anxiety and the fear get to you, and just push through and continue on making the best you can of every moment.
If you're quoting someone great, then I'll let you quote.
To quote the great archaeologist professor Indiana Jones, I don't know. I'm making this up as I go. How much of the documentary filmmaking process do you plan for pre-production, and how much of it is really just responding creatively to production challenges and just filming it as you go?
Well, I mean, Matt, maybe that's something you can speak to, which is, you know, starting out, you know, providing a brief, a creative brief, both with some aesthetic guidelines, some pre-research on the topic. But it seems like, you know, one thing that you all do very well on that front when working with companies like mine is to provide rails for us, you know, a box, but allowing us to sort of fill in the colors of that and figure out the best way to do that. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the vision and the guiding principles before we started filming this.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, every time you tell me more about the production, and you've told me a lot, I have more respect for you and for how this thing came together, because it really was one of those things where things were constantly going wrong. Yet when you came back from filming and you were telling me what you had gathered, we decided to increase the budget and increase the length and scope of the film. It was going to be like a 10-minute film. And you came back and told me how you got the photographer who was around at the time who photographed the whole thing. You got the Supreme Court justice who was on the Michigan Supreme Court that overturned the Polltown decision about 20 odd years later. And you got a law professor who was on the other side of the issue and all the other people. And so despite all the hiccups, you managed to get such an amazing set of content and characters that we wanted to throw more money at you and make it even a bigger film. And it turned into being about a 30-minute film. And I just think that you're absolutely right that you just have to work with what you're given. And while saying fix it in post is usually a terrible thing to say, it's there for a reason, which there are times like what you experience. There's nothing else you can do. You just have to get that interview audio and you have to fix it in post. And you did fix it. I was actually very impressed with how that audio went from being fairly rough to being where you can't really notice that there was any issue with it. So, you know, great job to whoever your audio guy is. And of course, you and your whole team.
Every producer's worst nightmare. But, let's make it longer and more expensive.
Correct.
Well,
correct.
But you know, to your point, Matt, I think content is king, right? Which is that a lot of filmmakers go into this thinking, what camera am I using? What's the best audio? And they forget that the content is more important than the gear you use. And I think this film is evidence of that.
Indeed, indeed. But it still ended up looking great. And I guess a good thing is it's probably always good. So you were the director and a producer on set. You weren't the DP, but you still had enough equipment on you. So when everything else was against you, you could at least pull out whatever camera you had and a DSLR or whatever microphone you had and scramble to make it work.
That's right.
So as far as the documentary filming process and how much plan goes into it and how much of it is responding creatively. We try to plan a lot with our documentaries. And I think that, you know, the more you plan generally, the better. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is going to go to plan. It's as obvious. And that sometimes not going to plan works out fine, or maybe even better because you were able to find all these great characters. What we did was, so we had a story that we wanted to tell, which is about 40 years later, this plant that was expanded for GM and a whole neighborhood was lost in the process. That plant's shutting down. So let's take a look at eminent domain. So we came up with a creative brief, and that process was, well, here's a general idea of the questions that we want to talk about and the topics and what the angle might be. And part of what we also came up with was I put together a visual creative brief, which was, what should this look like? And I was thinking about, well, this is from the 80s. It's from the early 80s. And it's during this industrial time as Detroit is falling from its place where it was, you know, where all these great cars were made. And it's now an economic despair, especially in the 80s. It was in a rough time. And so I thought about, well, what could our visual language of this be? And so it was maybe a mixture of two things. And one was sort of a general 80s aesthetic of thinking about like the cars from that time and the look and an industrial look with lots of factories and some bold colors in there. But I also really thought about that whatever side of the issue people may have been on in this film, it was a tough time for people. And there was people who were living in tough conditions and they were downtrodden. They were going to lose their homes. On the other side, people were fighting to have this factory because they wanted jobs. And so part of the idea around the lighting was, let's show this film in a way that has that feeling of people who are a bit downtrodden, who are kind of hard on their luck, and mix that with sort of a gritty industrial vibe that you might think of when you think of, you know, car factories in the 80s or just that culture in the 80s. So that was the original creative brief we came up with. It had some reference images and colors for what this could look like, with some ideas of how we could light the interview subjects. But it was maybe a one pager, maybe two pages. And then those may have been the guardrails or the guide rails that we gave to you. And then at that point, it was really, here's our general idea of what we're thinking. The look may be that would serve the story. And now you can take it and go run with it, which is what you did. And so then I'm sure there was a lot more preparation because at that point we handed it mostly over to you. I mean, we had, I think, weekly calls or bi-weekly calls, but for the most part, it was you and your team that was doing the bulk of the research and the planning, and figuring out how all that was going to go. So, I guess the way that I planned this out was I wrote a one pager and then gave it to you to do all the work.
Well, it was helpful. I do remember those conversations we had where we just determined more about the scope of the story. And I remember a conversation with you and Daniel where I think the film was originally going to be something like pre-Kilo and it was going to, you know, lead up maybe to the Kilo decision.
Yeah.
But we all decided that, hey, that might be too far of a story to tell. Let's just focus on these two cases, right? The Poletown case and then the Hathcock case, which preceded Kilo. And so narrowing the scope in on that was helpful. And then kind of as characters came up that I thought would be interesting, you know, being able to discuss it with you all, provide question lists, get feedback. And, you know, I ended up spending a lot of time actually reading the source Supreme, you know, the source court decisions and the law review articles so that I had a good understanding of the law going into it as well. And I was just really just honestly fascinated with the minds of the people we'd get to talk to who disagreed on something like this and try to draw out the heart of the disagreement. And what is it that underlies their rationalizations and their reasons, I guess, for how they decided this. So that was also a big part of it, was just making sure that I understood the law well enough to go interview some of these really great legal minds. But then also have the empathy for the various characters. And honestly, at the end of the whole story, I still really can understand both sides of this, right? Because a lot of people really needed those jobs and they really needed the economic benefit of continuing the growth of a company. And the very interesting thing about this is it was cross ideological lines at the time. I mean, you had the mayor who appears in the film, through stock footage, Coleman Young, who was more of a socialist, wanting General Motors to stay and siding with some of the, more industrial focused policy folks in the city. And then you had, like Ralph Nader and the Green Party coming in to side with the community. And then there was also the role of the archdiocese and the Catholic Church in the community. And there was some splits there as well. And so it was just a very interesting topic. And that always piques my interest when the dominant narrative of right versus left sort of breaks down and we find something that's more, human, or dare I say, something that's more local and it doesn't easily fall into a specific category. So whenever we find those kinds of stories, I think that they're ripe for storytelling and for, creating dialogue around.
Can I ask a question, Samantha?
Go for it.
All right. So Tim, what do you find is challenging about working within our brand constraints? Because when we handed the project to you, it wasn't, hey, we have a certain position that we want to tell in this project. It was more of like, here's this interesting story, but we want to be able to tell both sides and give our audience some context, but not really be pro one side or the other. Is that a challenge? And sort of how do you deal with that in your filmmaking process?
Well, I mean, I would say that's how it always is working with your organization, right? I have never been asked to provide a particular viewpoint or persuade the audience of a particular way of seeing something. It's always about identifying, various distinct positions and having a dialogue in the form of a film, which is really exciting to me. And most films naturally, need that kind of pro and con in order to create tension, which you resolve in some way, shape, or form. So I think the most difficult part is finding a resolution to very complicated, distinct voices. Sometimes the resolution isn't very clear. And one of the things with this film that was very hard to do was that the story was actually ongoing. And as you said, Matt, one of the reasons why this film, was brought up as an idea was because the plant had decided to shut down, right? And so everyone was like, wait, what happened? You built this plant, you took all these people's homes, and now you're just going to shut it down. Well, while we're making the film, General Motors changed their mind and they decided they're going to keep it open, right? And they're going to retool it for an electric car facility. So all of a sudden, the conclusion that I had been thinking was shifted on us, right? And now it's going to stay open. And then, another change happens and they retool it for electric vehicles. There's more fights around, are they going to keep as many employees hired and what are they going to do with it? So, the very nature of an active story that's unfolding in real time makes it a little bit challenging. But in this case, I think what we do is we just tell the audience that, right? This is an ongoing story. And that in and of itself, I think, is a very realistic conclusion because it allows us to be honest. And a lot of stories, I feel like, especially, films that I watch, anywhere, maybe even on Netflix, that they're forced into some kind of decisive conclusion in order for the audience to feel good about it. Where in reality, we live in a constant state of back and forth and resonance and contrast. And so I think that's the reality of life. And getting to make films that express that is something that aligns with me personally. So to answer your question, Matt, I actually really enjoy the constraints of these films. I think if I had to pick one other thing that can be challenging sometimes is making sure that the academic legal discussion is represented, right? Because sometimes I just want to spend the time with Bruce and tell his whole story or find the story characters. It's really helpful to have that pushback and say, hey, look, let's also make sure that our audience is educated on the law and the legal arguments. And so trying to find a way to blend, you know, more academic law with story can also be, you know, challenging, but I enjoy the challenge. And it, and again, that fits with my personality and my background of having studied, you know, in college, political science, philosophy, and economics. And I, you know, and that was my passion in college. So then coming out of college, I got very interested in filmmaking and telling stories and in aesthetics and in beauty and in art. And so it really does match up with who I am as a person, which is to want to tell very powerful stories, but still make sure that the story is grounded in and helps elucidate the implications of some of these more abstract ideas that oftentimes stay in the abstract and aren't brought down into the world, which is what I think story is really powerful at.
On the note of art, Tim, how essential was Bruce's photography to the story of taking Pull Down?
We could not have made this film without, I think, Bruce's participation. And he was extremely generous with his time, his energy, his continued support of the project, and in providing us with many hundreds of photographs for us to choose from and use in this film. And, you know, initially we had a much smaller subset of photos to use. And I think once I showed Bruce what the film was to become, I think he understood even better that the vision that I had been telling him all along truly was what we wanted to create here. And so he actually opened up the doors to even provide additional photographs for the film. And I've, you know, I just really am grateful to his participation in the film for that reason. But in addition to that, the way that he talks about the camera and using the lens of the camera to see the world and about his role in that process was really beautiful to me and really spoke to me. And I, he spoke like a true artist, a true photographer, a true, you know, somebody who really was there to observe, capture, witness, and provide a platform for these voices, stories, faces, people to live on long past that very moment. And I'm very grateful to him for not only providing that, but for being there and for taking the risk that, you know, many ways I felt like we were on somewhat of parallel paths, because as he was going through and photographing the community, you know, he faced challenges and had a journey of his own in not only photographing, but then developing and doing things with these photographs. And I felt very much like he inspired me along that journey to continue on and to try to do something similar, but more grounded in the present day. And then to be able to tie that strain back to his original photographs was just a really powerful experience and something that I think allows the story to breathe and to be grounded in both the past and the present.
It certainly does. I really do agree and am very grateful for Bruce both being in the film and his beautiful photos. I think you're absolutely right. It would not have been the same film without it. He was also such a great story character, which, you know, we didn't go into it and say, Tim, we want to make this film about Pole Town. We need you to go find a photographer that was there. You know, that was something that just that you happened upon through your hard work. And he really was such a good conduit to tell the story of what happened then. And then the fact that he had all these beautiful photos and he was so generous to let us use so many, you know, and it was hard to find enough stock footage and to find enough stuff to show what happened back then. And that he had these just gorgeous photos that were so, so well composed and just beautifully shot. And then we were able to use those. I think it really made the film so much better.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And you know, I think Bruce really had a lot of empathy for the journey that I was on, because, you know, there was a point when I shared with him why it was taking, you know, so long to finish the film and, you know, a lot of the snags, you know, that we were facing along the way. And I'll never forget, you know, he basically quoted to me a Paul Simon song, which is Slip, Slide and Away. And he said, you know, he's like, your story of making this film reminds me of the lyrics, which is slip, slide and away. You know, the nearer your destination, the more you're slip, slide and away. And then he said, and so I'm going to give you or provide to you more photographs that you can use to help, you know, glue this story together. And I think, you know, saying that back to me was just such a helpful way for me to see that he saw the journey that we were on and, you know, was willing to contribute even more and give even more to the making of the film. And, you know, so I just really appreciate him on a lot of different levels. He was also a support to me throughout the process in more than just, you know, one way.
What were some takeaways from your experience working on Pull Town that has impacted how you approach documentary filmmaking today?
It's a good question. You know, I think some of the biggest takeaways for me making this film, and I think I've already alluded to this throughout this conversation, but and I sort of borrow from, I guess, the Stoic philosophy here, but you know, Seneca says that a man suffers more in his mind than in reality often. And so with each and every challenge, to take it as a challenge and to not allow the mind to make it worse than it has to be, and to handle it with the most presence and honest, just apply reason to the situation and move forward as best you can. You have limited number of option sets, take the best one and move on, and don't let fear get in the way of progress or success. So I think that's a big one, because time and time again, applying that allowed us to end up where we did, which is with a very powerful film that I think we're all very proud of, and one that is, you know, both winning awards at film festivals and being shown in more and more locations all over the country. So that's something that's just really, really special. And I know Bruce is incredibly happy with it. But more than that, you know, the community in Detroit, I've watched Facebook discussions erupt in forums of people watching the film, talking about it and connecting it to their own lives. So, you know, I just am so glad that I was able to continue. I think that's one big lesson. You know, I think another lesson is I learned, I almost feel like I got like a master's degree in film licensing and fair use and in, you know, archival research, for example. I spent a lot of time in the archives and identifying footage for storytelling. So I think, you know, just learning how to go about that intelligently and properly is a huge takeaway for me. You know, another one is the value of the team. You know, every single person listed in the credits of this film truly, you know, they move mountains to get us to the end, right? I mean, really, every single person on that film went farther and deeper than I could have ever asked them to go. And as a result of that, we have something really special in our hands. Everything from the sound design to the musical composition done by Adrian, to the graphics that Joseph helped us create, and the rotoscoping of the images and the photos and the titles and the look, you know, to the team at FedSoc all the way through the process supporting the project, both financially and with other, you know, insights and help along the way, to the co-producers and production assistants on the project, to identifying subjects, lining up the calls, pre-research, and really just going all in on the project. And I think that the value of the team could not be overstated here in terms of the success of the project. And I think a big takeaway for me as a director is, you know, recognizing that you need every person on a project to give their utmost to get something, to make something great, and going about that and how to do that, I think is one of the big lessons, which includes being honest, you know, helping people see where you are, what you need, why you need it, but constantly painting this picture of the bigger vision and the impact that this can have from the very beginning. Because oftentimes I think people follow that vision that you're able to paint for them. So I think that was a huge takeaway for me as well. And then just on the content side, you know, and on the end game, you know, I think it's a huge takeaway for me that, you know, life is complicated. These things are not easy cut things often. And the role of the lawyers and the judges and the community members and the journalists and the policymakers, it's a tough job. I mean, this is really complicated. And oftentimes it's not, you know, like doing a math problem where you can see the answer. It involves human emotions, human lives, and involves economic calculus, but then also human calculus and the trade-offs and your presuppositions going into any situation. And it's really hard stuff. And so I just think it really helped me see and learn to put myself in the shoes of a variety of different voices anytime there's a seemingly clear cut answer a solution to a pressing, like a current problem. That doesn't mean we can't find a solution. And I think this film shows, you know, that there was a solution and a resolution found, you know, and, you know, just to give away, you know, the end, you know, Justice Young overturned Pole Town with the Hathcock decision after it had been on the books for many years. And so part of it, I think, is getting to see how something plays out, getting to see the effects of something, and then course correcting or you know, kind of going back to the way it should have been from the very beginning, acknowledging the errors of the people before you and moving forward with this new insight in place. And as you also see in the film, many states, including Michigan, took it to the legislature to amend their state constitutions, you know, to avoid these kinds of things happening again. And so, you know, there is really something beautiful about our, you know, form of government that allows us to have this, you know, checks and balances, which we all learn about, but actually see them work, you know, is a really powerful thing, and something that I really have taken away from this film.
I think it's a great answer. I don't have a whole lot to add, because I think you summed up a lot of this. It was certainly a team effort. I think the one thing that I might add is, for other filmmakers out there, is, you know, this project took longer than we expected and longer than we wanted it to, but it was important that we kept working on it until we got it right. And even though that made things stretch out longer and caused friction, we just wanted to make it right. And you know, even we were at a later cut at the of one of the cuts of the film, and one of the turning points, at least from something that I thought, was I showed the version to my wife, who's also a filmmaker and writer, and she had great ideas on how to fix some of the issues that we were struggling with. And so she played a huge role in getting the story to where it was. And Tim and his team kept working on this way past their contract, really, and just kept working on it until we had a final product. And his editing team did the same thing. So it really took a whole village to make this and to make it what it was. And I have so much appreciation for everyone who put so much time and effort into this. And what I'm really happy about is it's such a good film, at least from my perspective, but it's done great so far on the festival circuit. It won an award at Anthem Film Festival for excellence in filmmaking in the short documentary category. It just got accepted into the Better Cities Film Festival in Detroit. It was an honorable mention at the Richmond International Film Festival. And so we're all very proud of where this film came from and where it is now and where it's going. So big thanks to Tim and his team for seeing this through from the beginning to the end.
It even moved a woman to tears. I saw that happen live.
It did.
That's right. It did. Yeah. I think many people have been moved to tears by this film. You know, and even when I rewatch it, I get emotional every time.
Yeah. And I think the photography is a great conduit for that. If you think of what, you know, a big role of what filmmaking is to elicit emotion in audience members. And I think Bruce's photography was key in this, you know, preservation of a moment in time in a community, and really, you know, sharing with for posterity this emotional moment in one community's struggle to survive and eventually be demolished.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add about the making of Taking Pole Town?
Oh man, there's so much more I'd like to add, but I don't know if we'll have time to go through, you know, more of the process. But I do want to say I'm always open to conversations from other filmmakers who might hear this and have questions or want to watch the film. And my company Motivo Media is a, you know, we're a documentary production company, and we do a lot of other work as well. So if you ever find yourself in need of, you know, a production company to help bring a documentary to life, you know, feel free to consider us. And we'd love to take on many more projects like this one to continue telling powerful stories that both in capture the heart and engage the mind, which is what we consider to be our niche for documentary filmmaking. So, you know, I'm just very much excited to continue this journey of making films about important subject matter and helping people understand the world a little bit more deeply.
I would highly recommend reaching out to Tim and his company, Motivo. They are great people to work with. They do fantastic work and are also just a nice set of people who do good work and are easy to work with and are always honest and fair people. So highly recommend them.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah,
thank you,
absolutely.
Matt. I really appreciate that.
It's been great to work with you. And the only thing I would add is you can find Taking Pole Town on YouTube and fedsoc.org. And you could find it on other social media places. And check out all of our FedSoc films that are on YouTube and our FedSoc website. We have dozens of short films and hundreds of short videos on all sorts of topics. And so I encourage you to check it out and subscribe and leave a comment and let us know what you think about all the different work we're doing.
And Tim, where can we find Motivo's work?
Check us out at www.motivo.me for media. So that's www.motivo.me. And check out our portfolio page where you'll see a selection of our work, read more about the team, and get a better idea of the kind of projects that we take on. So yeah, check us out there. We're also on Vimeo. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram as well. So just search Motivo Media and you should see us popping up there.
Our guests today were Tim Hedberg, director and producer of Taking Poletown, and Matt Wood, director of FedSoc Films and executive producer of Taking Poletown. Thanks so much, guys, for being on the FedSoc Films podcast today.
It was really great to be here. Thank you, Samantha.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Samantha.
You can check out the film Taking Poletown on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.